Does he think that good outweighs the bad? Does he think, here, I've done a great deed and I need to pat myself on the back. What a great servant I am. You ever feel that way? You've done something good and you go on your way smiling. You can't quit from smiling. I did something great. You better be careful. Satan is lurking. And that's the time when he is probably most apt to strike, because you're least expecting it at that moment. How could he attack a great servant such as I? So, if you look at the various lessons that are taught in verse 1 alone, that's a brain full. But then in verse 2, now he's done what he's supposed to have done, all of his desire that he wanted to do, and there may be an emphasis there on what he wanted as opposed to what the Lord wants in the final analysis. But in verse 2, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Back in chapter 3, verse 5, as this very young man, he spoke with God. God spoke with him. God gave him his commission. Now, we went through this without the benefit of a chart last week. It was there, but we just didn't use it. But these four points deserve a little bit of emphasis. The first, the personal appearances he makes to Solomon. Psalm 115 gives one of the greatest caricatures of idols besides Isaiah that I think you can find anywhere in Scripture. I hardly know what else can compare except what Isaiah does. But in Psalm 115, he says in verse 3, now this sounds like Solomon in the wording. It's not, but it sounds like, our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. Did Solomon have silver and gold? Did he have the work of men's hands? Yes. They have mouths, but they do not speak. These idols are made of silver and gold, only the finest materials. They give them mouths as they paint the mouths on or engrave them into the precious metals, but they don't say a word. They have eyes, but they don't see anything. They have ears, but they do not hear. You could curse them to their face and they wouldn't know it. These are idols. They're nothing. Noses they have, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk. If you want them to go from here to there, you have to take them. They can't go on their own power. Nor do they mutter through their throat. The Greeks were famous for trying to make the people come to their idols and that they would listen as the ventriloquist would speak through the throat, through a little tunnel devised there. He says, they don't make any noise. Men make noises for them. Those who make them are like them, so is everyone who trusts in them. Solomon has twice seen God in some manifestation. He knows without doubt he is the true, the one, the only living and all-powerful creator of the universe. He knows it. He doesn't even have to have faith that's true. He knows that's true. Just as when Saul of Tarsus sees Jesus, he knows he's real. He didn't have to believe it. He knows he is. Solomon knew. And he turns to idols. They can't see, they can't hear, they can't curse, they can't bless. You have to take them wherever they go. How can a smart man such as Solomon fall to that? And then I ask the question, do we think we're smart? People in this society, are we smart people? We like to say we are, and yet we make idols of sports stars, movie stars, all kinds of people that we wouldn't want him to live in our house. All kinds of things go on, and people say, oh, isn't that great? Isn't that great? Oh, how entertaining. All the while we totally forget, as it appears Solomon has, that the most important thing for us is what's in his word. And then when the cloud is mentioned here, in chapter 8, verses 10, 11, and 12, I think that's on the chart, yes. And we went back to Exodus 40. He had a consistent sign of the one true God in addition to the two appearances. A consistent sign in this cloud. As the children of Israel wander through the wilderness, they have this cloud and this fire. And the next one mentions the fire. Now, cloud and fire are opposites. You don't think of those together. And yet God used both. He used the fire at night and the cloud by day. And so you have a cloud that's usually in heaven and a fire that's usually in the temple. But now we have a cloud in the temple and a fire from heaven. And you'll notice, as he speaks of this fire from heaven, I think about 1 Kings 18 on Mount Carmel, where Elijah calls down for that fire of God to come, and the people fall on their faces and say, "The Lord, He is the God. The Lord, He is the God." It's clear, frightening proof. They absolutely knew at that point. We don't need to be halting or limping between two views here. Baal couldn't have done this. Only the true God of Israel could do this. And since that's true, we dedicate our lives to Him. But is that how most Israel reacted? No. And Luke 4 makes that point. There are many widows in the days of Elijah, but Elijah wasn't sent to those. He was sent to this widow of Zarephath. And then the last one here, David's former eyewitness testimony. Solomon has more witness testimony than he actually needs. He could listen to his own father, who had heard God speak to him and who had been instructed by God. 2 Samuel 7 basically is the conversation God has to David about, "You'll not build me a house, I'm building you a house." What more would a person need? And yet he turns from this to idols. And we raise the question, why? And your guess is as good as mine. Then in verse 3, the Lord said to him, "I've heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually." Now, several things about this deserve some comment. 400 years later, the temple is gone. God said here in verse 3, "I've put my name there forever. My eyes, my heart will be there perpetually." A synonym of forever. How long is forever? Well, it's forever. Right? It's forever. So how can God not still have the temple when He said it would be there forever? In fact, let's make it a little fuzzier. Suppose the children of Israel remained absolutely, steadfastly committed to God and never went off into apostasy. The exiles to Assyria in 722 never occurred. The exiles to Babylon, 606 and 597, 586, never took place. They stayed there. They all served God, all one nation. There was no Jeroboam. They all did God's will. Would we still have the temple today? Would Jesus never have come and said, "I'm the true temple"? Would it not have been replaced? Wasn't there a time when that temple was going to end anyway? It was not forever. If that's the case, why does verse 3 come off here saying, "It's there forever, I'll put my name there as a perpetual reminder"? It's not perpetual if there's an ending to it, is it? Somebody help me out. See how confused I am? Oh,
I wasn't squinting enough to see that you said conditional promise up there, so I was going to say conditional forever.
Dave, was your hand up or are you pointing to Ty? Okay. Okay, I was a little confused. Okay. No, I didn't hear you even speak, but speak any time. Is that all you wanted to say?
That's all I was going to say. It's a conditional forever.
It is. Yeah, that's part of it. And is your hand up, David? Okay.
If you read on, you see the rest of God's statement to him about what forever means if you do certain things.
Yes. So the conditional nature of it. And Brother Jerry. Really? So it doesn't always mean eternity? How interesting. Does anybody know of any passages where it would be used like this? Let's look it up. Who wants to give me the first one? Okay, I'll give you one. Exodus 40, verse 15. I don't think I have those written down. Let me see. No, yeah, I do. See how easy that is? Exodus 14, verse 15. Aaron's priesthood. Now here's the priesthood of Aaron. Okay? "You shall anoint them as you anointed their father, that they may minister to me as priests. For their anointing shall surely be an everlasting priesthood." This is the same word, if I remember correctly, in all these. So it can be sometimes translated perpetual, sometimes everlasting, sometimes eternal, throughout their generations. So, the everlasting priesthood. What about Hebrews 8? Hebrews 7 and 8, what's it saying about the priesthood? Is Christ a priest after the order of Aaron, so therefore it's going to be a perpetual, eternal priesthood? No. What did eternal mean, therefore? To the end of the age. And that's how sometimes it should be understood. Leviticus 6, verse 13, the fire on the altar. A fire shall always be burning on the altar. It shall never go out. It shall never go out. And yet, is the fire still over there on the altar? No. Or look at chapter 6, verse 22 of Leviticus, the grain offering. The priest from among his sons who is anointed in his place shall offer it. It is a statute forever to the Lord. So the grain offering will always be offered. It's offered forever. 25:46. Here's a really good one. Slaves. They shall be your permanent slaves. So slaves will remain slaves to their master forever. Right? They'll be your permanent slaves. By the way, it's the word forever. So, what do we mean here? Is it forever? Is it eternity? It means pertaining to an unlimited duration of time, lasting for a duration. It depends on context. Now, let me illustrate why this is important. Go with me to Psalm 104. I mean, it's important because it's the Word, but there's sometimes, because of evidential reasons and doctrinal reasons, why we need to know this. We need to know this very well. Especially if a watchtower advocate knocks on your door. What's he going to tell you about the earth? How long will the earth be here? Forever. And he looks at a passage here and there that says that, doesn't he? Or if you talk to a premillennialist, some premillennialists, of which the watchtower folks are their own brand of it, 30-something brands, they'll say the same thing. Okay. This is Psalm 104. Look at verse 5. You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever. Suppose you have an earthquake that happens quite frequently. Let's say in Japan. And Corey probably knows far more about this than anybody here, but they build buildings, and then your buildings, that are at least, as best they can tell, earthquake-proof, right? I know you've studied that. Okay, do we have those here? Some? San Francisco, maybe? Not much? Okay, but not much, but in Japan especially, right? Okay, so they call Corey, and he says, all right, I've got this fixed up for you. Here's an earthquake-proof building, as best we can determine. No earthquake will ever shake these foundations. Does that mean that the earth will never be destroyed? He's not talking about that. What he's talking about in this verse is God laid the foundations of the earth. Now, if there are some earthquakes that occur, the earth's not going anywhere. It's still the earth. God laid it. It's in its orbit. It's going to stay till God is through with it. Now, whether God is going to be through with it at some point has to be learned from another passage, not just one that talks about how great its foundations are. The earth has great foundations, and that itself is figurative language. But look over it at 102. In 102, Psalm 102, verse 25, I'm skipping some verses, but verse 25, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. What are the next three words? They will perish. Which is right, Psalm 102 or Psalm 104? What's the answer? They're both right. How do we reconcile what appears to be a contradiction here? I'm a watchtower advocate. And I say, it tells me here in Psalm 104, verse 5, that the foundation of the earth will never be moved forever. Forever. How long's forever? How long's forever, Matt? How long's forever, Seth? How long's forever, Ty? It's forever, isn't it? Doesn't it mean what it says and says what it means? There you go. I've proved my point. What are you going to say?
Till the end of an age.
Yeah. How do you know? Well, that helps too. But don't bring that up.
But there's other passages that shows like the earth is going to be destroyed in 2 Peter.
Well, how about 102? How about Psalm 102? Of old, you have laid the foundation of the earth. He's talking about the foundation as in chapter 104, verse 5. That foundation? All right, what is he saying? 102, verse 25. You laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish. What does perish mean? You want to know what eternity means? I want you to tell me what perish means. What does perish mean? Does it mean it's gone? It didn't mean annihilated. Nothing's ever really annihilated. It changes its constituent elements. But it's not like it was. It's gone. They will perish, but you will endure. Something here is not lasting, and someone is. God's forever, but what He made is not. Further, yea, all of them will grow old like a garment. Like a cloak you will change them, and they will be changed. But you're the same, and your years will have no end. You see what he's doing? He's comparing God, who is eternal in the classic regular sense of that term, with the other things he's made that are eternal in the sense they fulfill their purpose until God is through with them. They go to the end of that age. All right, any comments? Matt? Okay.
The flip side of that is from a human perspective, when God says forever, that's all information we know on the subject. We are to continue in that vein until he tells us otherwise.
Until he tells us otherwise. That was the way with the Old Covenant, in fact, wasn't it? And then Ty? I'm dying to know what it is, but I fear trying to answer. Okay, Jerry. Brother Jerry.
I think the word perish there means actually go out of existence.
Yes. And by the way, Hebrews 1 quotes this passage. Thanks for saying that because I was about to forget. Hebrews 1, if you notice in verse 10, "And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth." Oh, that looks like Psalm 102. "And the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish." And the Watchtower folks, you know what they do with the word perish? I mentioned this a few weeks ago. The word perish to the Watchtower folk, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they call themselves, it means what? It means annihilated. Perish means annihilated. So when in Matthew 10:28, don't fear him who can kill only the body. Fear the one who can kill both body and soul, who can destroy. That word destroy, they say, that means annihilation. We're annihilated. Well, here it's used of the earth. What does it mean? It means annihilated when it applies to man. Here, it means it goes on living and existing. They say, no, it'll be renovated. Is man going to be renovated? Maybe that's what it means in Matthew 10:28. Take what they say and get the opposite, and you usually have the correct view of what the scriptures say. They will grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You fold them up. They will be changed, but you're the same. Your years will not fail. But to which the angels did he say? So he's contrasting Christ with the angels in this passage. He's eternal. So in the Old Testament, Psalm 102, you get the impression it's the Father and the consideration. Hebrews 1 makes it the Son. Because when you speak of the Son, you're speaking of Godhood just as you are the Father. They're eternal. Eternal in the classic sense of the term. But right here, the earth is going to perish. And heaven and earth will be destroyed, but my words will never be destroyed. Matthew 24:35. And then 2 Peter 3 that Brother Jerry brought up. Okay, time.
So the conditional promise that God knew from before he created the world. In Genesis, it was spoken of the prophecy of his son.
Mm-hmm.
And all the way up through the Old Testament, Isaiah 53, and how mm-hmm. man can be rejected by men.
And even in eternity, Ephesians 1.
And so,
yes.
I know foreknowledge does not equal causation.
Right.
And I know that that conditional promise was issued with the knowledge, God had the full knowledge, that they would not hold up their end of the bargain.
Right. He knew they would.
He prepared for that ahead of time.
Yes.
So, obviously, in a very theoretical sense, let's say that's not the way it was. They did hold up their end of the bargain. I don't see how that it's even possible. I think it's an impossibility that they could have held up their end of the bargain because God knew that they wouldn't. And I feel like I'm going into this like a space-time continuum that I'm like arguing with myself. It's almost like forever doesn't matter because forever wouldn't happen because the conditional promise, they wouldn't meet their end of the bargain.
That's right. Exactly right.
It's hard to wrap my brain around.
Right. I mean, this is deep stuff, but you're right. You're in the right place. Miss Joy?
I kind of think of that as God always has people. We don't know who were Christians in 300 or 400 AD, but God always has people serving him. So, the nation of Israel didn't hold to that bargain, but God always had people that did do what they were supposed to do.
We know that the gates of Hades would not prevail against his church. Okay, Matt, is your hand up?
Well, I think Romans 2 is partially an answer to why God would make that promise. Men need the demonstration that you're not going to be able to do this on your own.
Yeah. That's right, and also chapter 3, and also the fact that Christ didn't come in Genesis 4. Why? Falls in Genesis 3. Why didn't Christ come in chapter 4? It would be a short Bible, wouldn't it? You can memorize that pretty easily. No, the whole Bible, Genesis 1 through 4. Why? Why didn't he? There was the fullness of time in Galatians 4:4. And that fullness of time included giving these Jews all the time they wanted, as in Romans 7, to see they could not save themselves. They had to learn that lesson. It was not of themselves. It has to be of God. If you save yourself by your own perfection, you're never going to make it. You must depend upon God. Well, if we just had more time, if we could work at it a little harder. Now, there may be a number of other reasons too, but that much we know from Romans and other passages. Okay, any others? Tim?
The conditional promise is from God's perspective everlasting. Isaiah 24 verse 5 says that the children of Israel broke the everlasting covenant.
Everlasting covenant, yes.
So from God's perspective, it was to be everlasting.
Yes.
But when the two parties enter into agreement, when one breaks that, the other is released from it.
Exactly. If you look at the handful, and I don't have an exact number, of faithful Jews in the Old Covenant who remained faithful to God. People like Boaz, and I would say Ruth, and people like that. The few who really got it, and they die. They're going to be saved by the blood of Christ, we know. Romans 3, 25 and 26. It flows backwards just as it flows forward. But their covenant that they kept gives them this everlasting blessing in eternity because they were faithful to God during that time. Does everybody see that? Because they did what God said. They were men of faith, like the Hebrew heroes of chapter 11. The Hebrews, heroes. Men of faith who were under the old law. Yet look at the reward. They're not going to be rewarded without us, but they're going to be rewarded. Why? Not because they kept the new law, but because they kept this old, and it has the same benefits because of the blood of Christ for eternity as ours does for us. Okay. That's deeper than I meant to go, but any comments? Ty? Oh, this is going to be good, I'm afraid.
So, what are your feelings about Solomon?
About Solomon? I don't feel good. No, I'm sorry. I have gone through Ecclesiastes, I don't know how many times, saying, here's a man who tried it all. It failed. He's pointing people to God. If this is written, he says, as an old man, he's near the end of the book, he says, the only way you can do this is realize your purpose in life is to fear God, keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. He's going to bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it's good or bad. That could not be a higher peak in Old Testament literature. It is as high as it gets. And yet I cannot read through 1 Kings 11 without the realization that it looks as bleak as any passage I've ever seen in describing a person. Even Second Chronicles that tends to put the good side. It doesn't even mention the problems that David had with Bathsheba. It just mentions the good side of David. He's not painting a false color. He's just saying, you know about these others, and in the mercy of God, that's forgotten. We're not going to emphasize that at this point, but it's in the Bible. You can read it. But in speaking of Solomon, it's there in all of its confusing judgment.
So to piggyback on that, then, looking at Ecclesiastes, as an old man perhaps writing about the life that he lived, what would if a Jew who had lived a wicked life or had departed from God, how would a Jew reconcile himself to God towards the end of his life other than maybe the way perhaps Solomon did? I know some people contend that they feel pretty good about the way Solomon left the world and others don't. So yeah. What do you think about that? I mean, you talked about Ruth and you talked about Boaz and you talked about some others that were faithful or viewed as faithful. Even David was viewed favorably even with all of his shortcomings throughout his life.
Let me be very clear about this. I don't know Solomon's destiny. I just don't. I hope he repented just as David did. I just don't see a passage where it says it. Ecclesiastes may be that passage. When I read that in connection with 1 Kings 11, it doesn't give me as much hope as I would like. If he were one of my, well, we are related, we're all cousins. But if we were looking at him and hoping that he made it, I wouldn't feel very good about it. And we're going to have to get to 1 Kings 11, really, to see that. Now, is it possible? Oh, yes, it is. It's possible. It's just not recorded that I know of. He's advising others in Ecclesiastes. I don't know that he took that advice. He's praying in 1 Kings 8, one of the finest prayers you'll ever see, just before he goes off into this apostasy. So, I don't know. He's capable with his brilliant mind to say a number of things. But what he did, I just don't know. Right, Matt?
We don't know for sure what your Ecclesiastes before this happened to be, but it seems maybe so forth.
You mean wrote it before this apostasy? It's very possible. Very possible. Okay, any others? Okay, didn't mean to put a damper on the otherwise good mood here, but there's some things that we have to talk about. In verse 4, you have the setting forth of some conditions that are very, very serious. Now, God says, I'll put my name forever, and yet 400 years later, it's gone because there were conditions involved. So God illustrates what he's just been talking about. Verse 4. Now, if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness. Now look at David. He wasn't perfect. We know that very well. David sinned a number of occasions, especially with Bathsheba, especially numbering the people. So we know David sinned. But the general tenor of his life was he wanted more than anything else to serve God. That's a general tenor of his life. It doesn't appear that's a general tenor of Solomon's life. And God is warning Solomon, because at this juncture in his career, he's been very busy with building. The building was good. It's going to benefit a lot of people if they'll listen. But is it going to save him is the issue. So, he walked in integrity of heart. There's an object lesson here. And in uprightness, to do according to all that I've commanded you. And if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then, here's an if then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. As I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if... So now we've gone from the conditional encouragement to the conditional warning. If you or your sons at all turn from following me, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I've set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I've given them, and this house which I've consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. Israel was proverbial for its wisdom. If they turn from God in this way, they're going to become a byword or a proverb. We use bywords either good or bad. Remember the Alamo. You just say that one word, and it doesn't mean a lot to people today. But to Sam Houston and his men, it meant quite a bit, and they're willing to risk their lives because of those words. Remember the Alamo. Just that little proverb, that little byword. People will look at Israel, and he says in verse 8, as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? What did these people do to deserve such an incredible judgment of God? They look at the house and all of its ruins, knowing its former glory. Have you seen that house lately? And they hiss about it. And he says in verse 9, then they will answer, well, here's what happened. You don't know what happened? They forsook the Lord their God and brought their fathers out of, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and have embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this calamity on them. Now, if you turn over to 2 Chronicles 7 very quickly, 2 Chronicles 7, this is parallel to what we've just seen, and it has quite a bit of additional material. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 12. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. Deuteronomy 12, he says, I will pick out the place for you where you're to come and worship. He says, I have done so. Deuteronomy 12 is fulfilled. Now, in verse 13. When I shut up heaven and there's no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people. That's Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26. I'll send these if you don't obey to try to get your attention. Verse 14, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. That's one of the classic passages of God's grace in the Old Testament. I will heal you if you turn to me. Now, my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. I'm listening and I'm watching. I know what you are. I know what you've done. I know what you're doing. I know what you think. But I'll be listening if you want to pray and make this right. Verse 16, for now I have chosen and sanctified this house that my name may be there forever. That my name may be there. An empty temple is worthless. When Pompey, the great general of Rome, went to Jerusalem in 63 B.C., he says, I'm going... He had to fight the Jews off. He said, I'm going right into the Holy of Holies. And he did. You know what he found there? Nothing. There's no Ark of the Covenant. There's no means of sacrifice. There's no Day of Atonement. It was all a joke. They never knew what happened to the Ark. We don't know to this day for sure. A house without the name of God in it, or God connected to it, is just a bunch of materials. He says, I'll make my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. And as for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, to do according to all that I've commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then, if then, verse 14, if then, verse 17 and 18, if then I will establish the throne of your kingdom as I covenanted with David your father. Here's a firm rule that I have. You obey me and I will bless you. You disobey me and you will see my wrath. And he says, you shall not fail to have a man as ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments which I've set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot them from my land. Uproot. You remember the stony soil? If it has no root, what kind of fruit will it have? None. Stony soil bears no fruit. It's uprooted. It's good just to be uprooted. I'll uproot them. They're not bearing fruit for God. He's going to uproot them. They're the stony soil. I'll uproot them from my land which I've given them. And this house which I've sanctified for my name, I will cast out of my sight and will make it a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And as for this house, which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and this house? They will answer, because they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who brought them out of the land of Egypt and embraced other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore, he has brought all this calamity on them. This is as bad as it gets. Deuteronomy 28:37, you shall become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword. A byword means people will ridicule. You straighten up or I'll make you like Israel. Israel becomes a joke to the people. That's Deuteronomy 28. Prophesying what he says now to Solomon is going to take place if you don't take me seriously. Any comments? Tim.
I thought about, you mentioned retirement there initially. And it seems like to be a human tendency that we rest upon our laurels.
Yes, yes.
And there's a lot of admonitions here. Forget about what you've done in the past. You look forward. This is what you're going to do.
Excellent. Excellent. Any others? Dave?
I wonder if you're thinking through this. Solomon knew what was going to happen. And that was maybe why, in his human wisdom, he tried to make so many friends of so many nations. Was to stave off that thing rather than trusting God. See, a lot of wives, and most likely a lot of those wives would have come partnerships like Egypt and others would be.
So what nation is going to attack with all these alliances? Because these are marital alliances with nations. Interesting. If he did, then he's not as smart as he was touted to be. All right, thank you, everybody.